Welcome back to our first hour of Open Line. I'm Charlene Brown. Are you as intelligent as you're ever going to be at birth? Do factors like school, home, and culture make any difference? Author Richard Nisbett says those factors can indeed increase intelligence, and he's written a book, Intelligence and How to Get It, in which he explains how you do that. After we get a little bit of background, we'll let you join the conversation by phone or by email. Professor Nisbett, thank you so much for joining us on Open Line.
Thank you.
Your book talks about the hereditarian view of intelligence versus the new environmentalism. What do those terms mean?
Well, for a lot of people who study intelligence and for an awful lot of the lay public, there's a notion that intelligence is largely inherited, primarily a matter of genes. And we're finding that, first of all, estimates of heritability have been exaggerated. There are lots of errors, in my view, that people have made in attempting to assess heritability. So it's the role of genetics is slighter than we've thought in the past.
And what about environmentalism? What does that mean?
Well, we have lots of new evidence about the importance of the environment. A standard view for some people who study intelligence and a view that a lot of lay people share is that the environment is not terribly important. That sort of follows from the view that heredity is terribly important. But we're finding that, for example, school makes a great deal of difference to intelligence. You can't be smart as measured by IQ tests without school. There have been a lot of unfortunate natural experiments where kids don't get school for a year or two or three, and there are very severe effects on their intelligence.
And when you say natural experiment, what do you mean?
For example, black kids were shut out of some schools in the South shortly after integration. They just didn't go to school for two or three years. Big effect on IQ. In Europe, during World War II, there were some places where kids had no school for a year or two or three. Again, very big effects on IQ. But one extremely interesting finding in the U.S., which is, and this is quite new, is that summer school, school is essential even over the period of a year. If you look at what happens to IQ over the summer, kids drop a bit. They're out of contact with those intellectual things, and they actually drop in IQ. But there's a big social class effect there. People in the bottom fifth of social class actually lose quite a bit, and kids in the top fifth actually gain IQ over the summer. They're doing things that make them smarter.
Talk a little bit about social class, and then we'll talk a little bit about race, because those are two of the major things that you discuss in the book. How does social class, meaning pretty much your income level of your family, how does that affect your intelligence or your IQ?
Well, actually, just to say a bit about social class, we don't really measure social class so much in terms of income, although it's certainly correlated with the ways we do measure it. Education and the prestige level of the occupation are actually the way people tend to measure social class. And income is just sort of incidental. I mean, there are people who have very high-ranking occupations who don't make much money. We would want to say that they have high social status. So, but to get to your question, we now know that working-class people and people who are even lower socioeconomic status than that, people chronically on welfare, for example, just deal with their kids in different ways from what middle-class people do. And these ways almost surely have an impact on intelligence and on school readiness. One matter that's just very simple is talking to kids. And, you know, you might think everybody talks to their kids, but in fact, middle-class parents talk to their kids very differently from the way lower socioeconomic status parents talk to their kids.
Example?
Their conversations. I mean, a lot of what goes on in any family is reprimand. Stop that. Don't do that. Get out of there. But if you look at what goes on for the child of professional parents, that kid gets six encouragements. That's great, Billy. That's swell. You're doing a good job with that. Six encouragements per reprimand. The child of working class parents gets child of welfare black mothers gets 2 reprimands per encouragement.
And that's a huge difference.
They're absolutely massive, and it would, I can't doubt that they have a big impact on intellectual curiosity and on encouragement to learn about the world.
And what about racial differences? You say the people that say genetic differences account for differences in IQ are just wrong.
Right. Most of the evidence that they have is quite indirect, and if I told you about it, you'd say, gosh, that's the basis for the evidence. Some things like reaction time are different in a setup where you just say, light comes on, press the light. But we have direct evidence, which, for reasons that I don't quite understand, have not been part of the public discussion or even much discussed in the intelligence research literature. And there are 2 or 3 different kinds of direct evidence. The most telling to me is the fact that the U.S. Black population actually has about 20% European genes. There's been quite a bit of mixing of the races over the years. So now you can see, does it make a difference whether a particular black has 100% African genes versus, at the extreme, there are plenty of people, we call them black, and they actually are mostly European in their genes. Now, if your European genes are superior for IQ, it's just got to be the case that those people with more European genes are going to be smarter. And, in fact, that's not true, and we have lots of ways of looking at it. One way is looking at blood groups. You can get a pretty good bead on how African versus European someone is by looking at various blood group types. People who have more European, black people who have more European genes, don't have higher IQs.
And this has been studied, and you've found documentation to back this up.
Right. Lots of different kinds of studies make this point, other than the blood group studies. It was a study done of the very brightest black kids in the public school system in Chicago, kids who are actually genius level in IQ. Now, if European genes are an advantage, it's just got to be the case that these very, very bright kids are going to have more European background than the black population as a whole, and that's not true.
Okay. Now, you also discuss culture and as it relates to ethnicity or national origin. Talk about that part, because that also was a rather interesting finding that you had.
Okay. To give a little background on this, there are different cultures have different cultural capital. That is, they have different values on education, different values on hard work. They're able to place different demands on their kids. And this all pays off hugely in terms of educational outcomes and occupational outcomes. It's been true for every immigrant group that's come to the U.S. They've been regarded as dumb. Take my ethnic group, for example, which is mostly Scottish. When they got here in the 18th century, they were regarded as just beyond the pale. I mean, very unintelligent, very crude. And if you called somebody a Scotchman at that time, you were asking for trouble. When the Irish began to come here in the 19th century, they were generally regarded as virtually subhuman. And they were in the big cities of the north, blacks were preferred as neighbors and as employees over Irish up through the early 20th century. When the Italians came and the Eastern Europeans came, again, they were regarded as unintelligent. And in fact, they got lower IQ scores. The children of Italian immigrants at the beginning of the 20th century had IQs about 12 or 15 points lower than the population as a whole, which is about the gap that was the case until recently for blacks versus white, although that gap has been reduced in recent years. So the new group, the group without the cultural capital, always has lower IQs. They seem to the general public to be less intelligent. So the question becomes, why haven't blacks done as well as for example, the Irish had.
But exactly.
Separate question.
Mm-hmm. And what about the answer?
Well, first of all, how did the Irish get out of their predicament? And there was a lot of assimilation. It was possible for the Irish to assimilate in ways that it really wasn't for the blacks. One crucial thing, for example, is that Irish were eventually able to get into unions, which was the conduit to a good, solid working-class job. This was largely denied to blacks. It's hard to believe, but as recently as 50 or 60 years ago, blacks with PhDs were typically in very menial occupations, sleeping car porters or low-level post office clerks. So the occupational structure of the U.S., the ladder that many groups have climbed, has not been available to a substantial extent.
We're talking to Professor Richard Nisbett about his book, Intelligence and How to Get It. If you have a question for him, you can join the conversation at 292-8513 or email us at openline@wosu.org. Professor Nisbett, why was it important to you to show that heredity is not the whole story when it comes to intelligence?
Well, I've always kept up with the intelligence literature for my whole career. Most of my work has been on reasoning. How do people make inferences and judgments in everyday life? And a lot of that work has been critical because I think there are lots of reasoning errors that we chronically make, and much of my work was based on that. So that's close to, in some ways, the intelligence field. So I was knowledgeable about it, but I happen to be a social psychologist by training rather than someone with a background in genetics or primarily cognitive psychology. And it just always seemed to me extremely unlikely that something like intelligence would not be massively influenced by culture and by social class. But it wasn't until about 3 years ago when I started doing research, actually for a book not quite on this topic, that it began to dawn on me that that intelligence researchers had just gotten some tremendously important problems very wrong. Overestimating heredity, underestimating the role of environment in lots of respects.
And so you decided to investigate for yourself and quantify some of the reasons that you say heredity is not the full story.
That's right. To give you an example of the errors that were made in estimates of heredity, one basis for assuming that intelligence is largely a matter of genes is that identical twins who are raised separately have very similar IQs. So the idea is, well, look, the environments were different, and yet they are very similar, so that must be due to genetics. That's a mistake for two reasons. The first reason is that identical twins raised separately often means kids raised in the same town, often going to the same school, sometimes raised by relatives. The environments are not all that different. If you look at really different environments, which sometimes happen, you find that the similarity of identical twins is much less than generally assumed. But another way of looking at it is another kind of error that's made is think of two identical twins who are raised separately, both of them for genetic reasons, are somewhat taller and quicker than average. And think of the kinds of experiences that they're likely to have with respect to basketball. They're probably going to practice it more, get more rewarded for it, get chosen for teams more, get better coaching, and so on. And compare that to two identical twins who are shorter and stodgier than average. They're going to have similar experiences, too, even though they're raised in different environments. And they're not going to be so good at basketball. But in the way that heredity gets calculated, all of that difference between these kids, which is completely mediated by the environment, gets credited to genetics. And that's just a wrong way of thinking about it. The environment's crucial.
And don't you also mention in the book that you can take identical twins who are both tall, put them in separate environments to raise them, where one does get a lot of coaching and encouragement at basketball, the other gets none, and you get a difference in their performance in basketball?
Well, I would certainly expect that. We don't actually have data on that, but so that's what we call a thought experiment in my business.
Okay, so we'll leave that thought and talk now about kinds of intelligence. First of all, are we only talking about increasing intelligence in children who are still learning and growing and forming, or do your findings apply to adults as well?
Well, we know that the environmental experiences affect intelligence really at every stage of life. There's been kind of an overestimate in the popular view and even in the scientific view of the importance of the early years. The early years are important for sure, and they may even be more important than any subsequent stage. But you can, with certain kinds of interventions, you can very substantially affect the intelligence and the academic achievement of people at much later ages. For example, there's a type of very rigorous charter school called KIPP, or the Knowledge is Power program. Mm-hmm. This is for underprivileged minority kids, and they start at fifth grade. So these kids have had their deprived environments up until age 10. And I'll put them into that school, and in a study that was done for the San Francisco area school, KIPP schools. And let me specify what goes on in these KIPP schools. The kids spend 60% more time in contact with school than ordinary public school kids do.
Because of a longer school day and school year?
Exactly. The types of activities they have, it isn't just, as the education folks say, drill and kill. There's lots of experiences which are the kind of thing that upper middle class kids are getting. Museums, sports, musical instruments, art, et cetera. So these kids are getting basically a completely different experience from public school kids in general.
And now, it sounds like their experience is very rigorous and very disciplined as well.
That's right. And what strikes people who come into these KIPP schoolrooms is that they are like an oasis as compared to many inner city school systems. I mean, things are under control. Kids are having a good time. But the payoff is what happens to the academic achievement. These kids in the San Francisco area schools start out 25% are at or above national averages in reading. At the end of the year, 44% are at or above averages in reading. For math, it's even more dramatic. Kids come in, 37% of them are at or above national averages. At the end of fifth grade, 67% are at or above national averages. In other words, these kids, after 1 year, are doing better in math than possibly your kids or my kids, who are white upper middle class. Take it for granted you're white.
Wrong assumption there, Professor Nisbet.
Really?
Really.
Oh, interesting. Okay. So at any rate, we know that these kids and these KIPP schools are having a huge impact on their academic achievement. We also know that for college, for example, high school is a disaster for black kids. They start out 3/5 of a standard deviation. That's about 10 points lower in IQ than white kids. At the end of high school, they're a full standard deviation. That's 15 points in IQ lower than whites. Now, you took a look at those same kids and see what happens to them in college. And the answer is that most of the gap is eliminated in IQ just as a function of college in these same kids who were so much lower than the whites in high school.
So a good education can make a huge difference in IQ and results of measuring intelligence.
That's right.
And I should mention that we do have a KIPP school in Columbus. It's the first one in Ohio, so that experiment is going on right here in Columbus. What is it that causes that big a shift? What is it about the teaching that goes on in those environments?
Well, one thing that we know is that the teachers are really important, especially at the extremes. And some teachers, frankly, shouldn't be in the business and should be counseled out. If we look at kids, to give you an idea of how important especially the first grade teacher is, if you look at a kid who's expected to do poorly in grade school, either because both parents have very low education levels or because the kid has had behavior problems in kindergarten. And now you look at these kids and see who go into classrooms where the teacher has been rated as being in the bottom third in terms of teacher effectiveness. These kids, in fact, do have a rough time throughout elementary school. If you put these same kids into a classroom with a teacher who's been estimated to be, first grade teacher, who's been estimated to be in the top third in teaching effectiveness, these kids actually do as well as middle class kids through the rest of elementary school. So this is just a huge difference.
And yet often that difference is attributed to or blamed on the child and the parents.
Absolutely. And the parents will take the blame themselves often. I mean, there's just this, you look at the person who's behaving in a certain way and you assume there's something about the person that's manifesting itself rather than looking to the situation.
So what can a parent do as far as your child's education, if it's that important at the beginning to have someone who basically knows what they're doing? What is the parent supposed to do?
Well, in other words, how should you raise your kids?
Well, no. I mean, is there something that you can do as far as the teacher that your child has?
Well, I mean, you know, I can say everybody should try and get that good first grade teacher, but everybody can't. So the school system needs to, there needs to be some pruning of teachers who are at the bottom of teacher effectiveness. More importantly and more benignly, there ought to be better instruction in how to teach in education schools. Common complaint that you hear from teachers is they didn't get enough experience teaching. Our system is so different from, for example, the Japanese system. In the Japanese system, teachers, it's understood you can't be a good teacher first trick out of the box. The first 10 years of a teacher's career, people visit the classroom, critique the teacher, and it's just taken for granted. You're not going to hit your stride until you've been doing it for several years.
I'm going to ask you to hold the thought right there, Professor Nisbett. We need to take a short break here. But when we come back, we'll continue our discussion with Professor Richard Nisbett, who has written a book called Intelligence and How to Get It. This is Open Line. I'm Charlene Brown. This is WOSU 820 NPR News in Columbus.
First, former rock journalist Jancy Dunn wonders why her mother is getting a tattoo. Then, musician Melody Gardot shares the story of how music saved her life.
There's something about music. It goes to a place in our brain that's very different. And that was sort of the turning point. For me, it was very, very soothing.
Mothers, Daughters, and Music, next time on Bob Edwards Weekend from PRI, Public Radio International.
Bob Edwards Weekend is on Saturday afternoons at 2 o'clock right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. Good morning, I'm Amy Jurovich. Thanks for joining us for the special encore presentation of Open Line. No phone calls this hour, please. But then at 11, Open Line Weekend live with WOSU News host Marilyn Smith and a panel of food critics. They will discuss where to get the best food in Central Ohio. That begins in just about 30 minutes right here on WOSU. If you're getting rid of a car that's still in fair condition, consider donating it as a part of the Car Talk Vehicle Donation Program. Your donation is tax deductible and proceeds go to WOSU to help support your public broadcasting listening. Call 1-866-789-8627. That's 1-866-789-8627 for information on how to donate your old car. And currently 75 degrees in downtown Columbus, sunshine today and a high of 85.
Welcome back to Open Line. We're talking to Professor Richard Nisbett, a professor of psychology at the University of Michigan, about his book, Intelligence and How to Get It, in which he says that heredity is not the whole story on intelligence. There are things you can do to improve your child's IQ. And a moment ago, we were talking about teacher training, Professor Nisbett, and the need for more experience-based training, for one thing. What about having teachers get higher degrees, does that make a difference? Does that help improve the children's performance?
No, there's no evidence that higher degrees improve performance. Those higher degrees typically aren't based on more teacher experience. They're based on more theory, and that's not what a teacher needs to be effective in the classroom.
What about teacher pay? That is often an issue when discussing the quality of teaching in any given school district.
Well, certainly I'd like to see pay increased. For some reason, the teaching profession, when I went to school, which is a long time ago, teaching was a more valued profession than it is today. And teaching has just declined in prestige. And I think the prestige of the occupation is more nearly the problem than pay. But pay would certainly help to increase the prestige of the occupation. And I think it would be great to have higher salaries than teachers do.
And you say it's also important to reward the good teachers.
Yeah, it turns out to be, it surely is. It turns out to be a kind of a measurement problem to figure out who are the best teachers. Sometimes, for example, a principal may put kids into a very good teacher's classroom precisely because the children have problems or are anticipated to have problems, and the principal thinks this teacher is very good and will be able to deal with these better. But those kids are probably going to be kids who are not going to perform terribly well, so that the teacher can end up looking worse than is appropriate. And actually there are economists who are working on this problem, and other behavioral scientists who are working on the problem of teacher evaluation. And one of the ideas that's come along is evaluating on the basis of value added. So take a third year a teacher who's got kids coming in, and they've done well or poorly to some extent before they ever get in her classroom. So if you look at a kid who, say, was in the 30th percentile in first and second grade, and now you're going to see what that kid looks like at the end of third grade. If that kid has gone up to 50th percentile, then you say there's been positive value added by that third grade experience. If that kid has slipped to the 15th percentile, you're going to say there's been negative value added or value subtracted. And in theory, that sounds like an excellent way to evaluate teachers. There turn out to be problems even there. But nevertheless, I think we should do it, and we should reward the best teachers.
So we just need to figure out a way to do that effectively.
That's right.
All right. We're talking to Professor Richard Nisbett about how to improve intelligence, how to increase your child's IQ. You can ask a question or offer a comment at 292-8513 or email us at openline@wosu.org. What about the trend that we've seen increasingly over the past so many years toward testing more to measure children's progress in school and to ensure that they are progressing as they should be? Talk about achievement tests and their value towards improving your child's both IQ and performance in school.
Well, testing per se is not going to improve performance or IQ, but you do want to have testing, and I think primarily for academic subjects. I mean, I don't think there's much reason to test IQ routinely of kids in school, and in fact, that's much less common than it used to be. What you do want to test is academic achievement. That's what we care about. We don't care about kids who are smart and don't do well in school. We care about kids who are doing their best in school. Of course, the complaint of a lot of people in education and out of education is that there's been more teaching to the test. And that's become especially common since No Child Left Behind, where, on the other hand, that's on the one hand, teachers complain about it. On the other hand, you hear good things about No Child Left Behind, in the sense that the necessity for keeping social class and racial records of what's happening is that more attention is given to lower class kids and to minority kids, and many people think that's a good idea.
Okay, let's take a call now. We have Kathleen on the line. Hello, Kathleen. You're on Open Line.
Hi, Charlene. Thank you. I wanted to ask a question about, and I guess maybe question a bit how the classifications were chosen for making judgments about the numbers of reprimands that children get and the number of positive comments. For example, and I did turn in just a little bit late to the show, but what I did hear was that the classes talked about were the professional groups, working class groups, and mothers or families on welfare. And what I'd like to just suggest is that the welfare really isn't a class, and in fact, welfare has really not been, receipt of welfare or cash assistance payments really has not been a group as such for at least a decade. In Ohio, for example, families cannot even be on cash assistance for more than 3 years. And so what we really see are people who are churning in and out of the cash assistance system, and they are working and then losing that job and getting cash assistance for a little while and back to work. And I also wonder if Professor Nisbet had looked at some other factors and sort of, you know, might say sliced the population a little differently. For example, families where alcoholism is an issue, I would think, I would expect, although it may not always be the case, that you might have more reprimands and less positive comments, and that can be cut across all the classes. So I wonder if he could just address some of these concerns that I have.
Okay, let's do that. Professor Nisbet, what about how was it determined, the ways that these families interacted with their children according to their socioeconomic group?
Well, first of all, let me point out that the caller is certainly right that situation with welfare parents is different from what it used to be. Although, as a matter of fact, even 15 or 20 years ago, the average person on welfare at any given time had only been there for a year or two or three. So the stereotype was that people get on welfare and stay there forever, and that was never really true of welfare. It often did serve the original intention, that is, to get people through a rough patch. We do know that that the different social class groups are behaving differently. We do know that mothers who are minority group and who are not employed or chronically unemployed or temporarily unemployed and so on do have socialization practices which are different from those of, for example, middle class whites or blacks.
But her question was, how did you determine that? How do you study how a mother interacts with her children?
Oh, well, actually, good question. You just go into the home and watch. And there have been the studies that do that are relatively recent, and they find pretty dramatic differences. You just go into the home and observe things, and you see how many books there are. You question the parents about how frequently the kid is taken out in the world, whether the kid ever goes to museums. You find out whether the kid is read to. You find out whether there's a computer in the home, how it's used, and the characteristic way that the parents, usually the mother, interact with the child.
And this goes on over how long a period of time?
It would be several hours, but usually several visits of an hour or two each would be typical. And you get big social class differences in these kinds of things that would encourage intellectual exploration and academic achievement. And in fact, if you look at parents who are, let's say, at the 84th percentile, homes that are at the 84th percentile on the overall score on these tests, and compare it with someone who's at the 50th percentile, that's worth 9 IQ points for the kids. That's a very big difference. It's very significant.
Okay, you're a little confusing talking about percentiles. Can you put that in simpler terms?
Okay, well, 50th percentile just means someone at the average. 84th percentile means in the top 84%.
Okay. So,
And if I might, I guess the other question, though, was what kind of confounding factors did the professor look at? For example, I would think that homes where alcoholism is an issue, not necessarily the parent that's being observed, but other people in the home, might create an environment that was different than if alcoholism wasn't an issue. The same with other kinds of situations. For example, if you were to observe at a time that the parent was unemployed, that might be very different than if you observed the same home at the time that the parent had recently become employed again.
Right. I have the same intuitions that you do, but I don't know of any evidence directly on that question, except that if mothers drink alcohol during pregnancy, of course, that puts the child at great risk for intellectual impairment.
So there's really nothing that's been documented about the influence of, say, other adults in the home who have problems, alcoholism, drug abuse, mental health issues?
You know, there may well be, and I just don't know about it.
I guess my concern, and I can't say it as an argument of my own because I haven't done this kind of research, but my concern is that we may be assigning certain behaviors to class when, in fact, you know, kind of what I think of as a horizontal sort of slice across the population, when, in fact, maybe we need to be doing some vertical slices across the population and looking at other kinds of influences and behaviors. It's just a concern. I don't, you know, I have no evidence either.
Okay. All right. Kathleen, thank you for your questions. We appreciate that. Adding to the discussion. We now have Fred on the line. Hello, Fred. You're on Open Line.
Good morning. Thank you. My concern is this. Having had the good fortune to have been born, you know, quote, gifted, I can tell you that in my own experience and in working with many others over the years, intelligence itself, I find, is less important than the ability to pursue a goal and achieve it. By using IQ, is it because we know that being able to have children increase their reflection on IQ also reflects that they are better better skilled or enabled to be able to determine a goal and then work towards it?
Okay, that's a great question. I would have several approaches to that. One is that IQ tests measure what you could call analytic intelligence. They're the ability to think on your feet, to approach abstract problems. Often problems on IQ tests aren't very intrinsically interesting. They reflect, in part, general knowledge like vocabulary, information about the world, and so on. And IQ test scores based on those kinds of measures are certainly associated with, they are predictive of, lots of things, like how smart people's acquaintances think they are. The higher your IQ, on average, the higher the intelligence estimate of friends and acquaintances. And the higher, the better kids do in school. There's a very substantial prediction of that, and the better they do occupationally. But the caller's intuition about what's important is really getting lots of support recently. I actually say in my book, now this is going beyond the data, but if I had to choose for my own child between a high IQ and high self-control and organization, I would go for those latter traits. There are some kinds of evidence that indicate that this is true. For example, a wonderful study that was done started about 40 years ago with nursery school kids at Stanford University. These kids are all faculty brats. They're all very bright. And you put them into a situation which measures self-control. You tell the kid, you can have a cookie now, or I'm going to be gone for a little while, and when I come back, if you call me back, I'll let you have two cookies if you wait for a while. And some kids grab that cookie and eat it. Other kids sit there for a long time waiting for those two cookies. Now, you look at those kids 15 years later when they take the SATs, and the kids who had the most self-control do much better on the SAT tests. So, and SATs are partly a reflection of IQ-type skills, and they're partly a reflection of just how hard you work. Another kind of study that's been done looks at kids in a junior high in Philadelphia, a magnet school, and these kids are tested in lots of ways for self-control. Part of this, like willingness to delay gratification, say you can have $1 now or $2 the next week, self-reports about the ability to focus on things and to put pleasure aside until the work is done, parents' reports about self-control and so on. You add all those things together, those predict grades a lot better than IQ does. And then entirely aside from that, there are different kinds of intelligences, just sticking on the intellectual issue, and analytic intelligence. There's practical intelligence, just being able to figure out how to get along in the world, and there's creativity, both of which really count for a lot and don't even correlate all that well with IQ tests. They're not that close to IQ tests in terms of what they measure.
So, Fred, it sounds like you're on the right track if you're guessing that those other qualities are much more important than IQ, like setting goals and being able to work towards them.
We have our daughter is gifted as well, and one thing we find is that's great. It gives her a leg up, but we need to make sure that she pushes through and doesn't stop when something gets hard. So that's why I was personally interested in this. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you for calling in. And that is something else that you talk about in the book, Professor Nisbet, that determination and hard work absolutely make a difference, and you cite Asian cultures as the proof.
Right. I mean, there's a stereotype that Asians are brighter than non-Asians, and a lot of people go beyond that and say, well, not only are they smarter, but it's genetic. They just got better genes than the rest of us do. But in fact, the best evidence we have, and it's not great, is that there is no IQ difference. It's very hard to compare, certainly across cultures. How do you measure intelligence in Japanese as compared to English? But there are some nonverbal tests of IQ as well. And to the extent that we have evidence about that, there's no indication that East Asians have higher IQs. Actually, in the studies that have been done, for example, in Japan, you look at kids in the first grade in the U.S. and in Japan, and the Japanese kids actually have lower IQs than the American kids at that point. I'm pretty knowledgeable about East Asian cultures. I've written a book about it, and it's not surprising that would be the case. Americans spend a lot of time on intellectual things, teaching their kids things, and that's much less true for East Asians. They spend much more time on social and emotional kinds of tasks, teaching the kid how to behave properly, how to be sensitive to the emotions of other people, and so on. But at any rate, those IQ differences are gone by fifth grade. There's just no difference at all at that point. Meanwhile, the Japanese kids are just light years ahead of the American kids in math, and that has everything to do with the quality of teaching. It has everything to do with the parents' belief that ability to do math is something that you get by virtue of working hard, and the ability of people in Confucian cultures like Japan, China, and Korea to put greater demands on their kids, partly because they believe that effort is what counts.
And it sounds like Americans don't believe that strongly enough.
Right. Well, I start my book with a sad story about myself. When I was in fifth grade, I was sick for 2 weeks, and that happened to be the 2 weeks that they took up fractions. When I got back, I was just lost. I was at sea, and for the next few years, I didn't do very well in math. But my family said, oh, don't worry, Nisbets have never been much good at math.
So you actually were given a pass.
That's right.
To not do well in
Absolutely.
Math.
Absolutely. Don't worry, kid. I didn't worry about it that much. And I'm suffer from it today. I mean, my graduate students make fun of me because I'm so lousy at statistics. Because my parents had basically a genetic view of IQ, that East Asians, even in Confucius, you find an idea about some of what talent is a gift from heaven, which we would say really is genetic. It's something you have at birth. But most of what talent is something that is the result of the experiences you have and the hard work that you have. And China has had an experience now for 2,500 years. The poorest kid in the village could become the highest magistrate in China by working hard and studying, because that's the way you got into the government, was by your score on an exam. So they're quite confident that hard work pays off.
Okay. Let's take a call now from Susan. Hello, Susan. You're on Open Line.
Hi.
Hi. You have a question?
I have kind of an interest. Yes, I do. I have twin daughters. And I had a very interesting experience with studying IQ in these twins. I had one daughter whose IQ was way above average and one that was slightly above average. And watching the way the schools treated these two children differently, one was in all the gifted programs, all the advanced programs, and the other not. And today they're 26, and both of them are incredible overachievers. They were both straight-A students in high school. They both graduated with honors from college. One is second-year law school. The other is starting grad school at Yale. And my daughter, who actually does not have as high IQ, I would have to say, is much more socially well-adjusted. She could run a small country. So I'm wondering if we do our kids harm in pigeonholing them in some ways because of their IQs. And I'm reminded of what my very bright daughter's gifted teacher said to me when she was in elementary school, that being as gifted as my daughter was like wearing your nerves on the outside of your skin.
Ooh.
And these kids really, really... they're incredibly intuitive and perceptive, and they really suffer in some ways. So we think of it as such a wonderful thing, but in fact, it can be a very difficult challenge, especially for a young child.
In what way? I'd be interested to know in what way.
I think they are they're socially isolated. They tend to be, at least from my just objective observation, they tend to be. They keep to themselves more. They tend to overthink things. Decisions are more difficult. Real life kind of things that come at them quickly are more difficult for them to process. They tend to be more bookish, which is particularly difficult in the middle school years. So this kind of gets exacerbated in the middle school years, this sense of isolation and being different and set apart in some way. And the expectation then that the parents have of this incredibly gifted child, I mean, they're just pushed and pushed and pushed often, you know, beyond their limits to be involved in all these different things and to be pushed in ways that a child with an average or above average IQ is not pushed and is able to simply enjoy their childhood more.
All right.
Do you have any experience with this?
I don't. I'm very interested in your observations. And I mean, of course, a lot of it rings true in what I know. On the other hand, I do think there's quite a bit of individual differences among kids. I think some kids wear their brights more lightly than you're describing. Actually, in terms of the data on adjustment, emotional and social adjustment, are the higher the IQ, the more socially adjusted people are in
really?
General.
Yeah, that's interesting. It's not my observation, both with my own children or with peers.
Right.
Not my observation at all. But I'm finding your conversation fascinating. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for calling, Susan. We appreciate your contribution. What can parents do if they want to try to help their children do better in terms of intelligence overall?
Well, there are lots of things. Some of them start before the child is born. Mothers who exercise tend to have kids who are brighter. We don't know that there's a direct correlation, a direct causation there, but I would say, since that's the association, I would recommend exercise. the evidence is fairly good that breastfeeding is a good idea. That seems to increase IQ. So that's something that happens very early that's very important.
What is it about breastfeeding that contributes to IQ?
Well, there are certain fatty acids in breast milk that seem to affect the nervous system. If those are absent in animals, the animals are not so bright by the test that we have for animals. There are substances in breast milk which directly affect the nervous system. That's the current assumption about what's going on there. Talking to kids is just terribly important, and literally having conversations. If you put a tape recorder on middle-class parents and working-class parents, you'll find there's a lot more conversation. The kid says something, mom says something, kid says something back in response to that. It's a back-and-forth conversation, the kind you'd expect between adults, which is much more common. The child of professional parents has heard 30 million words by the time she's 3 years old. The child of working-class parents has heard 20 million. And the child of black mothers who are on welfare has heard 10 million. And there's big differences in the richness of vocabulary as well, not just the number of words, but the level of vocabulary that the kid is hearing. And it's very likely that these things are causing differences in intelligence and in school readiness. It's important to just plain talk to your kid and to encourage intellectual exploration. In later life, it's important to believe that intelligence is malleable. It's important to think like an Asian here, that intelligence is under your control. And in fact, here there have been experiments done. You can, people who have gone into poor minority schools and just tried to convince these kids that intelligence is under their control, showing them pictures of what happens to nerve endings growing toward one another as the learning process goes on, and kids are really affected by this. I mean, some kids cry when they understand that, you know, it isn't just what they're born with, it's what they can do that can matter a great deal.
So it's basically telling them you are smart or you can be smarter if you work at it.
Right. And these kids, in fact, do better in school after you've convinced them of that. The academic achievement is greater. So believing that your kid can do it, and then demanding of it. I mean, Asian parents have more control over their kids' activities because they come from this Confucian tradition where the family is very strong, and the kid just learns that, you know, you've got to work hard, and you've got to reflect well on the family. Achievement motivation is very different for different cultural groups. For my cultural group, mainstream white Americans, I mean, achievement is all about me. It's, you know, look at me, how smart I am, how accomplished I am. For the Asian, accomplishment is about, you know, reflecting well on the family, or at least avoiding shame for the family. And that gives them much more control. If I don't think I'm very smart, or if I don't care whether I do very well, or I don't care whether I have a high-class occupation, I can opt out. And Asian kids, they can't opt out. Mm-hmm. That's just the culture just won't allow that.
Literally, failure is not an option.
Exactly.
Okay. Any final thoughts? We have about a minute left. Any final thoughts on how parents can get information on what to do differently and how they can do better?
My book has some suggestions. To just say a couple of others, I mean, you want to avoid praising kids for intelligence. You want to praise for hard work instead. And this relates actually to something that the most recent caller said, that if you praise for intelligence, it makes kids nervous and they won't tackle as demanding tasks.
Okay, we're going to have to end it there. Professor Nisbet, thank you so much for being with us on Open Line. Richard Nisbet, his book is Intelligence and How to Get It. This is Open Line on listener-supported WOSU and WOSU HD 820 Columbus and streaming on the web at WOSU.org. WOSU 820 NPR News. From NPR News.